Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we are speaking with Dr. Damon Scott about his book published by the University of Texas Press in 2024, titled The City Aroused, Queer Places and Urban Redevelopment in Post-War San Francisco, which is a really interesting history. It's a history of a queer environment. It's a history of urban development. It's very much a history of a post-war city, trying to figure out what that means in terms of labor, in terms of economics, in terms of city planning, in terms of what the city wants to be. So there's obviously quite a lot to get into. So Damon, thank you so much for joining us to tell us all about it.
Miranda, thank you so much for that rousing introduction and also your interest in my book. I'm happy to be here to talk about it.
I'm glad to have you. Could we start, please, with you introducing yourself a bit and explaining why you decided to write this?
Of course. Sure. So again, my name is Damon Scott. I'm a geography professor at Miami University of Ohio. This is my first book, first full-length monograph. And I think the best way to kind of introduce the book is to say a little bit about how it did come about as my very first foray into kind of the archives. I see myself as an urban historical geographer who looks at questions of the post-war city and its impact on the social geographies of people, particularly queer people. And so as a graduate student, I spent a summer as a summer intern at the GLBT Historical Society of Northern California, which is essentially a community-based archive in the city of San Francisco that has its roots back in the late 1970s among a bunch of people who were sort of living through a changing city and collecting oral histories, collecting organizational records, collecting publications into this rich archive of material about the queer history of San Francisco and the kind of a Bay Area region. When I arrived as a graduate student in geography, they took an interest in my background in cartography and ability to use mapping software to generate spatial representations of places. And so they connected me with one of the archivists who was the keeper of this amazing list. People refer to it as the sites list or the queer sites list. The person that I met with had inherited it, I think, from several other people who had worked on it. And essentially, it was a set of Word files that all had tables in them that included names of places, addresses, and in some cases, information about dates in which particular sites in the city had some connection to kind of gay history or the gay past. It included bars, bathhouses, restaurants, sites where there were raids, a whole bunch of different things. And so they asked me to create a map. And I created a map, a large poster size map of this database, again, essentially just addresses and names of places. And in the process of creating that map, I kept running into these problems, these mapping errors. The software package that I was using kept saying, unable to map these places. And I looked more closely, and it was a handful of places On the San Francisco waterfront, at the end of Market Street, in the area around the Ferry Building, was anyone able to map them? What I quickly realized are these places, there was maybe 10, 15 places or so, or at least names and addresses, is that those addresses no longer existed because I was using a modern contemporary map, and I was trying to map them in an area that had been a 28-block area that had been torn down and rebuilt. And so not only are the where the buildings gone, but the street grid has completely been reconfigured. And so this book really is the story of those places that I was unable to map in that early foray. And in the process of writing the book, it took me into a lot of different directions and a lot of different archives. Most importantly, it took me into the archives of the city to try and understand a little bit more about the urban planning history and urban development history of San Francisco in the post-war period, because many of these places dated to late 1940s, and they all disappeared in the early 1960s. So it's really the results of my quest to understand the origins, history, and fate of a handful of bars on the San Francisco waterfront that flourished in the two decades after World War II.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction to the project and the book, and how it so helpfully lays out where we're looking and when we're looking. Can we therefore talk about what we're looking at? What do you mean by queer land use? And how do you use this role in identifying the kind of what at the focus of the book?
Great question. Queer land use is a term that I began using myself. It just kind of emerged from trying to understand the histories of these places and how they originated. It's a term that I coined. It's not one that I found elsewhere. It was a helpful term. It has been a helpful term because what I was really looking at are patterns of commercial activity that accommodated non-normative sexual desires during this period. Places that provoked anxieties about urban decline, places that undermined urban land values, and places that fueled post-war urban redevelopment projects. I like the word queer land uses better than maybe more familiar terms like gay bar. The kinds of places I'm talking about were largely drinking establishments, but it also include hotels and lunch counters and different kinds of drinking establishments. I like queer land uses better than gay bar because gay bar to me signifies a more kind of sexual identitarian sort of politics that emerges in the 1970s and a little sort of later period. It's not that gay bar was not a term that was used earlier. The earliest occurrence I've seen of the use of the term gay bar in the city of San Francisco was in the mid-1950s, but queer land uses signifies a much more inclusive way of thinking about sexual and gender non-normative populations and publics that inhabited these places. And also, again, these places were not just bars. The final thing I'll also say is by intentionally focusing on and using the word land uses, I really want to center the narrative in the book on questions of land ownership, land tenure, property leases, and in particular, the role of state actors operating under a very particular vision for managing post-war urban development and normalizing and stigmatizing different kinds of commercial activities. It's really about the ways in which people and city leaders, particularly people using the powers and tools of urban planning and urban design that are trying to kind of make changes in this area. And they're talking about it in an often stigmatizing ways. The book focuses on how marginalized sexual subjects created, adapted, defended, and reconstituted queer land uses in the face of large-scale urban landscape destruction. And I'll just say one more thing about land uses. This area, again, roughly a 28-block area at the foot of Market Street near the Ferry Building, historically was a place where there was a jumble of different, what I would refer to as sort of sailor town land uses. There were hotels, cigar stores, clothing shops, coffee shops, naval stores, locker clubs, places that people who were tied into the maritime economy, either because they were dock workers loading and unloading boats, ships, or because they were sailors who were passing in and out of the port. This was the place that they stayed in town often in between work assignments. So the mix of kinds of buildings there that were really dedicated to this sort of subset had a kind of occupational kind of maritime economy that sort of underlie the earlier use of those areas.
Mm. No, that's very helpful. Thank you for helping us understand kind of what we're looking at, who we're talking about, both in terms of minority sexuality, as well as the jobs that we're looking at. Because that does very much come into play as the time goes on. But I do want to add one more thing in, or really ask you to add one more thing to this mix.
Of course, sure, yes, please.
To what extent was this waterfront with people on land, at sea, going back and forth between them, a variety of sexualities, it's at, you know, different kinds of businesses? To what extent are we also talking about a racially integrated place or a racially mixed place? And what were some of the drivers of that?
Really, really great question. I'm really glad that you picked up on that thread. To kind of understand a little bit more about the who of sort of who inhabited and passed through the waterfront during the 1930s into the 40s and the 50s and 60s, it's important to know a little bit about kind of the history of maritime labor unions and union organizing. And I really have to give credit to the amazing, trailblazing work of Alan Barrowbay. This book, Coming Out Under Fire, talks about experience of and gays and lesbians during World War II. And his subsequent research has focused particularly on a group called the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, which was a really important labor union operating on the Pacific coast out of Pacific ports. And in his work, what he has sort of shown is that as early as the 1930s, San Francisco was a center of a very particular kind of like a cross-racial, cross-sexual kind of social solidarity within the labor union movement. And it occurred in part because of the dramatic advances that came in the wake of a major strike in 1934 that shut down the Western ports and resulted in maritime workers having much more leverage over the conditions of their labor. And in particular, what it meant is that maritime laborers were able to organize and negotiate labor contracts over time and also have the ability to set up their own hiring halls. These were places where they would keep a roster of active members of the union. They would sort of rotate through job assignments and they would detail or they would send work gangs or labor crews to the waterfront to staff these contracts that they had negotiated periodically with shippers. And so this sort of system of contract labor with labor union halls also had within it, I'm going to get into your question about kind of the racial kind of geographies of this system. Maritime trades were segregated in a kind of racial hierarchy. And in particular, the waterfront workers who were part of the merchant marines, when I say merchant marines, I'm referring to the people who were working in the civilian naval, non-military people, but working aboard ships at sea. Within this labor force, you had an important subset of them that were part of the stewards department of ships. And what that means is, particularly on passenger liners, these are the staff aboard ships that would tend to the needs of the passengers. So the stewards department had the cooks, the janitors, the cabin attendants, the pastry chefs, the bartenders, the porters, a whole mix of the kinds of people we often think about as being associated with a hotel on land. This was a kind of fraction of the labor force on these passenger ships in the 1930s and 40s. And they tended to be disproportionately places that had a higher number of people of African-American. There were more Black workers in working aboard this kind of labor in ships, as well as what were referred to at the time as queens, gay men who worked as waiters or other stewards aboard ships. And so in the 1930s, after these labor unions were able to kind of create these hiring halls, you see a growing power and leverage and social solidarity among people in this kind of like maritime trade group. And they often kind of fought against efforts to undermine the solidarity of the group that came from either kind of racial divisions or homophobic divisions or ideological divisions. And again, I'm drawing a lot on Alan Barabay here to kind of draw this out. They were very proud, this labor union, the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, were very proud about fighting against what they referred to as red baiting, queen baiting, and race baiting of their unions, right? And so what happens during World War II, so this is already established in the 1930s, what happens during World War II is there's a major labor shortage on West Coast ports, and particularly in San Francisco, which is really the center of operations for dispatching troops to the Pacific theater of war. So large numbers of service members coming through, but also a lot of ancillary wartime industries involved, and not a lot of workers. And so during this time period, in the 1940s, these labor unions on the waterfront, maritime unions of the civilian Navy, became much more racially integrated because of the demand for labor, and also certain labor unions having a history of being a little bit more open to kind of racial integration. And so by the end of World War II, it's estimated that about 20% of the longshoremen in San Francisco, the people loading and unloading ships, were African-American. And it's estimated that in the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, which had a membership of about 19,000 people, about half of them were African-American by the end of the war. And so I can see this from sort of, you know, statistical demographic sorts of bits and pieces I could find. But also you could even see it in the land uses of the kinds of places and who were occupying them on the San Francisco waterfront. I saw examples in census records of several different residential hotels that were part of this maritime sailor town economy of, you know, sailors staying in town on, you know, in between sets of sea that was predominantly African American. We saw also kind of a jazz nightlife culture in some of the bars on the San Francisco waterfront, as well as from oral histories, some recollections of cross-racial sexual tourism and same-sex desire in the basements, in cruising zones, and in the YWCA on the San Francisco waterfront.
Hmm. That paints a very clear picture of sort of where we're at the moment of ending World War II, and also helpfully how we got there. So thank you for that answer. If we then move to the post-war word, really, in the title, there's a pretty big change that happens to this community that you've just described and sort of set up for us with the Merchant Marines and the Naval Forces that, to my reading, when I read that part in the book, I was like, wow, and there's still a waterfront after this? Mm-hmm. So can you walk us through kind of what is this big change and what does it do to the queer waterfront?
Yeah, well, I great question. And what I would say is, I think things really get complicated and interesting in the late 1940s. And it's not World War II and the ending of World War II. It's the onset of the Cold War. It's this rising tensions. In the wake of the Communist Revolution in China, there's an enormous sense of anxiety and concern about subversives entering into the country and undermining American, you know, political life and cultural life and power structures and so forth, as we all sort of know about during the Cold War. But the way it kind of played out on the West Coast, I think deserves more attention. And I've tried to draw some of this out in the book. And that is that there was a great deal of concern about these port facilities and the potential for the infiltration in port facilities of this sort of, you know, spreading communist, you know, threat throughout the Pacific. And what begins to happen And it happens first under the Truman administration and then again under the Eisenhower administration, is a program to systematically screen subjective subversives and homosexuals out of the merchant marines. And other scholars have written very beautifully about the ways in which during the Cold War, homosexuals were targeted in all kinds of different sort of government bureaucratic and military positions. A lot of that focuses on, in part, what happens at the federal level in Washington, D.C., but it also is happening systematically on West Coast ports in particular, because West Coast ports and West Coast labor unions had a longer history of being more ideologically aligned with leftist causes, had been more organized, and were also on the western flank of the country facing the Pacific Rim, right? And so one of the first places a systematic program was set up to issue papers to port workers and then check the identities of those workers against records, criminal records, happened on the San Francisco waterfront. And the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union was one of the sort of primary targeted, most leftist sort of labor unions that saw the beginnings of this intensive sort of scrutiny, right? Well, similar things are also happening in the Longshoremen's Union. And then in a non-civilian context, it's also happening in a military context through sort of the armed forces as well. And so this process of screening really systematically kind of unrolls in the early 50s through a series of, again, these administrative state sort of control over the labor unions, leads to a population of displaced maritime workers who are no longer given port access to jobs on the waterfront, yet they are still hanging out. They're still going to, they're seeking out opportunity in these informal waterfront hangouts, these hiring halls, the bars, the taverns, the cocktail lounges, and the hiring halls on the waterfront. And San Francisco becomes a really important place where a lot of this activity is happening. I think in part because there's this idea that San Francisco is a place that at least has a longer history of this, success in advocating for and having sort of social solidarity among waterfront labor union workers, right? And so, so that begins happening, and you start seeing then, in the context of the Lavender Scare, you start seeing local officials and state officials identifying and calling out and targeting bars. And one of the bars that was targeted early on was the Black Cat Cafe. The Black Cat Cafe is a place that many people have written about as a place that the owner of that bar successfully fought a long legal battle that went all the way up to the California Supreme Court. And one of the key issues in that battle was over whether or not he, as a straight man, owner of this bar, had the legal right to serve homosexuals. So it was and he won that case, and it was seen as a kind of civil rights victory, early civil rights victory for gay, lesbian people. But it actually emerged in one of these bars. It was tied very much into the kind of West Coast kind of maritime waterfront labor economy, although it wasn't directly on the waterfront. And I'll just add a couple other things. You start also seeing in about 54, 55, places like the Sea Cow Cafe, which was a bar that was actually the very center of this earlier labor fight that I mentioned in 1934, that kind of established, the greater leverage for maritime unions. By 1954, is a place where transgender and queer people are sort of hanging out, and it's being raided by the police, and also a place that gets a shout out, as I mentioned. In the Mattachine Society, a homophile organization, had an early conference in the city of San Francisco and offered the conference goers a kind of short, sort of guide to the city of places to go, and suggested that they go to the Sea Cow Cafe for beer and semen, S-E-A-M-A-N, right? And it is now becoming to look like and take on the character of a gay bar, right? Or at least in the parlance of the time period, what was referred to as by the police and in the press as a, quote, hangout for homosexuals. Mm.
All right. Well, you've mentioned the police, so I think this is a good time to bring them into the conversation now that we've got an idea of what's happening and developing on this waterfront. And as you just mentioned, right, gaining, it's known, it's gaining some amount of notoriety. So how do the police, how does the city government react to all this?
Yes. Well, you know, I guess when I started this project, you know, and from some reading histories of the city and, you know, kind of like kind of popular cultural kind of understandings of like, you know, the history of this terrible period of bar raids in the city that, you know, left, you know, queer people in the city, you know, terrorized and afraid to kind of go out or, and which I think some of that a lot of that did happen. When I look at the sources and you look at kind of the commercial histories of some of these bars, what you realize is you see a lot more persistence than actually closure. So the places that I was seeing, they lasted a really long time. But if you only look at the periodic sensationalized police, you know, stories in the newspapers, stories of public crackdowns or street sweeps or roundups, and those definitely did happen and they did terrorize people. And that was a really dark, terrible period. What you also begin to learn and you sort of see is that those places very quickly and quietly sort of reopened. And some of them, there's evidence of actually the direct role or participation of police in allowing them or facilitating them to sort of do operate and remain open. And so, for example, a place called Jack's Waterfront Hangout or Hideaway had different names. For a period that it was in operation, was actually owned by the Port of San Francisco and then owned and then sold to the California Department of Highways. And those state entities operated as essentially the landlord for what was a kind of known gay bar, right? These places advertised relatively openly in coded language, but it was kind of a little bit clear what was going on. In nightlife columns of the city, in regular newspapers, but the most damning sort of evidence of the kind of awareness and participation of police in the operation of some of these bars is the Gayola scandal that kind of broke through into the headlines in 1916. What it exposed is a whole system of police graft in which police officers, you know, were and also state liquor agents were showing up on a monthly basis to get a cut of the proceeds of the bar tabs and also maybe picking up a couple bottles of liquor, sometimes bringing their wives or girlfriends. It was essentially kind of a holder. How I sort of think about it is it's a little bit of a holdover of a kind of like a prohibition sort of world of speakeasies, where places are kind of hidden and concealed from sort of plain view, but not really to sort of completely hide them or make them invisible, but instead to allow law enforcement plausible deniability when they're exposed that they didn't know anything that was going on. They were unaware those things were happening. And so I did see bits and pieces of examples of the role of police in actually facilitating the opening and the closure and the movement of some of these places. And what that added up to me was to sort of see that by the late 1950s, the period of sort of large, like of like sensationalized bar raids and bar crackdowns, you know, splashed over the news. It tended to kind of come around political moments and political decision times, had turned into actually a process of kind of trying to sort of manage or steer queer nightlife away from certain areas and towards other areas. So I think there's a spatiality to this that you can kind of look at if you look at opening and closing and some of the decisions that were made that come out of this Gayola case and sort of where there was permissiveness and where there wasn't permissiveness. And you see a lot more crackdowns on, for example, a neighborhood called North Beach, more crackdowns in the Tenderloin, and a more kind of laissez-faire attitude about the waterfront. And what I attribute this to is that by the by the mid-1950s, city leaders, elected officials, and also business leaders working together had already kind of settled on this idea that the San Francisco waterfront, at least the area around the Embarcadero, was going to be redeveloped. It was going to be transformed into a totally different physical landscape that took advantage of the two new major bridges that spanned the bay that were open at the beginnings, just before the start of World War II, but never really had the full effect of transforming commuting patterns and land use patterns. Those become very much on the mind of city leaders in the post-World War II period about how to shift away from a kind of maritime waterfront ferry building oriented world to one that was devoted to the automobile, and also to kind of reconfigure and rethink about the city as being really the administrative and financial core of an expanding Bay Area metropolitan region in which the kind of maritime land uses and the maritime kind of infrastructure would be relocated out of San Francisco and largely shift to either the periphery of San Francisco or across the bay to Oakland. So those sort of longer range sort of plans were already kind of being talked about off of behind closed doors. And this is the moment also in which essentially they had kind of given up on the waterfront and treated it as a kind of managed vice district and steered queer nightlife to Lower Market Street for a brief period during which it kind of grew and flourished in pretty amazing ways.
In some ways, I want to like not stomp on the flourishing in amazing ways, but we do have to kind of stick with the actual history, unfortunately. Yes. So staying on the, I don't know if we want to call them evil, corrupt politicians, that might be going too far the other direction, but this whole plan for the redevelopment behind closed door side of things seems to come out in the open very much around this word blighted.
Yes.
When and why does that word really become, in a lot of ways, it seems, a weapon against this flourishing community? Well, tell us about kind of this word and the role it plays.
I will do that, but let me just circle back to flourishing, and I'll just say there are bits and pieces and glimpses of this flourishing queer nightlife world on the waterfront that I was able to sort of gather and consolidate and kind of interpret from this amazing archive of oral histories that were collected not by myself, but by people who were connected to the Gay Lesbian Historical Society. These are interviews of people, many of them World War II veterans, or people who transited the city during this time period, who weren't really being interviewed about the waterfront itself, but were just being interviewed about their experience of the city and what it was like. And often you see these bits and pieces and references to places on the waterfront. You can stitch them together and kind of get a sense of the flourishing of it. But to your question about the blightedness, the connection between flourishing and blightedness. So blight is a very specific word that has a lot of a power. Blight is a word that is used in a kind of planning context with legal implications. To declare an area blighted, this was a kind of administrative procedure that came about as a result of urban redevelopment laws. One of the first urban redevelopment laws in the country was the California Community Redevelopment Law in 1945. And one of the justifications behind that law was to actually redevelop the San Francisco waterfront. So very early on, one of the main projects the state legislature in Sacramento wanted, among other things, was to kind of redevelop the San Francisco waterfront. At that moment, they were focusing on the produce market area, the area where the warehouse district that where fruits and vegetables were brought into the city to be distributed by retailers. And so in that law and other laws, blighted, to declare something blighted means to create a map and draw a line around a certain area of the city and designate it blighted, which opens up the possibility of utilizing state power of eminent domain to acquire land to put it to a higher economic purpose. So the way they would operationalize or kind of calculate what blight was is an area, a block, a neighborhood, a section of the city that is taking more tax revenues than it's giving back it's a net drag on the city's coffers. It's a kind of economic kind of, you know, formula in there to kind of figure that out. Once those areas are declared blighted, what that means is they are candidates for applying for large amounts of public funds to acquire land, buildings from owners at fair market price for public use, tear those buildings down and rebuild them. And so there's state power and also money that goes along with declaring things blighted. It's a way of condemning something, but it's condemnation that has the power, full power of governmental authority to kind of intervene in the urban land market and completely tear down and rebuild, sections of the city. And so the implication was for the San Francisco waterfront, and there were several, you know, the beginnings of rumblings of plans to redevelop the waterfront and describing it in kind of like pejorative ways that it was obsolete, that it was dilapidated, that it was dirty, that it was dangerous, that it was a site of sexual predation and gender, you know, abnormality. These are all kinds of like tropes that were used to kind of reshape the imaginary of what was going on the waterfront to sort of promote and justify and rationalize declaring the air blighted. Those all took time to kind of work their way through. But the air was officially blighted, declared blighted in 1954, 55. And in that blight declaration, city leaders drew a line around 28 blocks, which really pretty much corresponded to most all of the sort of maritime land use quarter of the city, which was the produce market, but other things as well, like these sort of hotel, maritime seamen's hotels and other sorts of things. But it took about 10 years or so, a little bit less than 10 years to actually act on those plans. And so once it's blighted, it discourages any further investment. It creates this sort of holding pattern of these places where there's this intense desire of the state to kind of acquire this land, but there's also this interest in downgrading its value so that you can actually purchase it for a lower and lower value. So there was a sort of logic here in steering queer nightlife to the waterfront as a way to further depress the sort of land values and the cost of acquiring this land to rebuild it. And I think it was in that logic that this sort of like moment of allowing things to happen there unabated and relatively unpoliced, but subject to extortion by law enforcement, creates this sort of context in which there is a lot of queerness happening on the waterfront. I mean, the descriptions of the San Francisco YMCA in the 1950s from multiple people who visited there and recalled them in oral histories are lurid. I mean, they refer to the place as like an open brothel, that the people who even live in the city would sort of check in, for the weekend, because they knew that, the shower stalls were kind of a cruising zone, that people had, it was just a kind of open sexuality in the halls of this YWCA, because it was anything goes kind of zone.
Which is fascinating, thinking about kind of what the word blighted means legally, economically, and also sort of in the popular imagination. Is there anything further you'd like to tell us about queer land uses after kind of this word has been deployed, but as you said, as it's sort of trickling down and hasn't actually kind of kicked people out yet?
Yeah. So in this period, I just referred to as a period of flourishing, and I would say that period is sort of like the late 50s to early 60s. You get interesting characters. I shouldn't say character. Interesting. The kind of coalescing of a queer bar culture along the waterfront. And one of the interesting places to bring to the book, there's a couple of chapters that focus on specific locations and how those sort of changed over time. And they're kind of meant to kind of go together to sort of see how things were under this this older regime of police-controlled, managed, regulated, sort of speakeasy-like, underground-like vice. And that was a place called the Ensign Cafe. Had some other names as well. On one hand, it goes back all the way to World War II, at least, if not older. And then across the street, there was another place. The address was 90 Market, but the places that were in 90 Market, the names of places changed. There were multiple places in the same space. It was a really large space that was had a cocktail lounge with multiple bars in it. It had a restaurant in the front. From the outside, it seemed relatively unassuming, one door or two. But once you entered, you could go all the way back to the building, and it really occupied much of the lot of that area. That building, 90 Market Street, was a site, and this really, really blew my mind. And this actually kind of came out of trying to understand a little bit more about the history of these places. There's a very close connection between 90 Market and the Black Cat. And that connection is in the sort of actions and the operations and the life of a really important and treasured figure in San Francisco, Jose Saria, who's known pretty well as somebody who was a singing waiter at the Black Cat, who went from singing kind of campy sort of songs to the some crowds, so then offering a kind of regular Sunday drag performance in which he lampooned the police and drew big crowds. And always ended his performances with a kind of an appeal to the people in the crowd to kind of stay together, to hang together, to together, sang together. If we're divided, they'll catch us one by one, was something to that effect, what he said. Well, people in San Francisco know a lot about this figure, and he's even has a national sort of profile in terms of the importance. And it's largely linked to his, not just his role at the Black Cat and kind of from the stage, calling on people to kind of come together and form a community and act together, but also for his being the very first person to run as an openly gay person for a position in public office. He ran for the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. It didn't win, but it was a demonstration of the political power and the size of the gay community in the city. And he has a much more interesting and even more compelling kind of life beyond that, in which he was very much involved in the creation of a whole organization that organized queer bar performers into a kind of pantheon of aristocratic, realms and regions in the international court system of drag that is international and still exists today. Anyway, so that's a lot about Jose Saria. But what was not clear before I wrote this book, and what the book does show, is that Jose Saria was really instrumental in actually expanding beyond the Black Cat to setting up operations in 90 Market, which was a much larger venue, which had a showroom and a stage. I got receipts in his personal archives of buying lumber and nails and things to kind of reconfigure the interior of that space to make it his big sort of show palace. He kind of essentially was the manager and ran the place, but he also set up in the front of it a lunch counter. And he was aspiring, a business person, not just a performer, but also a business person. In his lunch counter, and I think there's a really interesting parallel to other kind of civil rights sort of histories of lunch counters and the role of kind of mobilizing people to kind of push back against, state violence. So he's running this lunch counter in, 1960 or so, in 90 Market, in the center of center of this sort of urban redevelopment area. And across the street is Southern Pacific, which is a big transit shipping company, and during lunch hour, a lot of its employees are flooding out into the street and coming across the street and having lunch, and a lot of them are queer. And so people in these reminiscences of San Francisco during this time period talk about the Southern Pacific building, which had a giant sign on the roof with its initials SP. It had the reputation, it had this sort of nickname as the Swish Palace, because the large number of queer, like clerical staff that would sort of flood across the street, at the end of the day, but also during lunch, they would come across to Jose Saria's place. And the executives at the Southern Pacific tried to shut him down. They tried to put him out of business. They threatened his customers that if they continue to go there, that they would be fired. And Jose Saria sort of talks about in an oral history, that was the impetus for him to actually get organized, to kind of mobilize people, to show political power and strength at the voting box. So I think it's powerful and interesting that right here in the middle of this urban redevelopment area, this sort of entrepreneurial kind of queer drag person who's the son of immigrants from Latin America is seizing on and taking his sort of political power as a person who can rally people, his customers and people in this kind of bar culture on the waterfront to assert their rights in the community. And he also gets involved not only in running for supervisor, but he also gets involved in starting one of the very first newspapers, gay newspapers in the city called the League of Citizens Educations, the News, or the Citizens News, and the name's changed a couple times. It begins publication in 1960, and it becomes publication as actually the organ to promote his candidacy. But it also becomes the first example of a gay newspaper, regularly published, serialized publication that begins offering advertisements. So you start seeing the very first advertisements of gay bars listing kind of the entertainments and the, a roster of fundraisers and all kinds of other things. And what they're actually doing is not only raising political awareness and getting people to kind of register to vote and show their political power, but they're also organizing commercial interests and raising money for a legal defense fund to protect the right of business owners that begin in this period also to be facing eviction orders, letters from the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency that they need to kind of vacate the premises, leases that are suspended, and a heightened period of more policing and also vigilante violence of groups of thugs coming in and beating people up. And it was a really dark sort of period. And this is sort of the 1962, 63, at the moment in which land acquisition is finally happening. And there's this immense sort of power that comes down on trying to kind of evict through whatever means possible this and dislodge this kind of queer world on the waterfront. And this is a moment of political organizing, of social consciousness. It's a moment of the city becoming aroused.
All right. Well, there's two threads there I really want to ask you to tell us a bit more about. So I think I'm going to ask about the sort of political organizing side first, and then we'll talk a bit more about the evictions and the police. What you're describing with the newspaper, with the organizing, with the allusions, the lunch counter allusions that we see with the civil rights movement, this really is sort of community political organizing. But maybe San Francisco's waterfront queer bars is not necessarily where we think of the origins of the gay rights movement coming from. Why do you think it's important to maybe change that picture and center that origin here?
So it's really a great question. So really inspired in my work both by Alan Berube, have already mentioned, but also John D'Amelio's work on gay communities and gay organizing. And so John D'Amelio sort of talks about this really important sort of moment in which the homophile organizations and the gay bar cultures kind of come together and unify. And that is sort of what he identifies as sort of moment of kind of like the emergence of a kind of gay community kind of logic or a gay community sort of framing of political rights and fight for minority rights. I hope I haven't oversimplified his arguments, but that always sort of struck me kind of went, that totally makes sense to me, but I wanted to know more about the sort of the gay bar part of that and the pre sort of homophile organizational sort of story of that. And I think it happens in 90 Market Street. I think it happens. There's a moment in which at 90 Market Street, Jose Saria invites the police, representative of the district attorney's office, a homophile organization representatives as well. And he wants to have a conversation in 90 Market Street at this bar. It was called the Talk of the Town at the time. He'd just become sort of a part of it. a conversation about kind of lessening the kind of raids and arrests and the harassment of gay bar patrons. And kind of work, you know, kind of working with police to kind of, you know, get them to sort of back down on this sort of crackdown. And it's kind of at this moment that the homophobe organizations, which were really powerful and really important through the mid 1950s to early 1960s, I'm talking about the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis, as well as some others, nationally are really important in the United States. Give San Francisco its national significance and importance as a kind of gay mecca and a kind of early, really important place in which queer people begin to kind of make assertive rights for civil rights. But the Mattachine Society and Daughters of Bilitis, they were always very kind of cognizant of not talking about specific places. They never mentioned bars, they never mentioned restaurants, they never mentioned the sort of lived experience world, queer worlds in which their members sort of circulated in. In part, I think it was to kind of, you know, pursue a kind of politics of legitimation and normalizing, you know, queer gay citizenship. But it was also about protecting those places from being targeted or broken down on, right? And so this all kind of breaks down on the waterfront when these queer land uses become the sites in which a new politics about protecting, defending, preserving, actively promoting, reconstituting in new places when places are shut down, where preserving the kind of the gathering space and a place for these queer drinking publics to kind of reconstitute themselves, it really leads to kind of a different kind of politics. It's a kind of, it is a community-based, emergent bar culture kind of politics that I think is an important kind of like pivot point in the logics of you know, activists during this time period who are pursuing, you know, rights for, you know, minoritized gender and sexualized subjects, right? So I think that's really important. I think the other thing that's really important is the sort of queer history of San Francisco has, you know, the sort of historiography of it has really emphasized a lot the really important, the importance of people like Harvey Milk. It's centered around a kind of narrative about the gayborhood, the creation of a gay neighborhood, you know, a commercial zone where there's a whole bunch of different kinds of what I would say queer land uses that are, you know, bars, bookstores, you know, all kinds of clothing stores and so forth. I think what my book sort of shows is something about what was the pre-gayborhood sort of world of San Francisco? What did it look like? It wasn't organized in a kind of neighborhood sort of sense, but it did have a sense of social solidarity. It had a kind of investment in places, but those places look quite different. And I would say that the kind of the catalyst for people to kind of, you know, showing up, showing out, and pushing back against, you know, several decades of harassment is the loss of physical spaces. It's about the kind of like the loss of the city underneath them, which does happen. That whole area does get torn down and redeveloped. But it also requires an enormous amount of energy and effort, organizational power and energies and solidarity to then begin reconstituting, you know, their kind of social spaces in other areas. And now they've got, you know, a publishing mechanism, they've got a newspaper, they've got all kinds of new organizations that kind of flourish after this moment of the shutting down of the queer waterfront and the proliferation of more queer / gay land uses that kind of, you know, that rise to the level of actually something that's visible as a neighborhood.
Hmm. Really interesting to see those threads carry forward. I did promise, however, that I was going to ask you a bit more about the police, because I thought this was a really interesting aspect of the book. Because in a lot of ways, the image we've painted so far is, of course, true of the kind of, okay, everyone's getting eviction notices. All right, there's really an increase here in pressure, in violence, and intimidation. But you also talk about in the book that it's not exactly the same for every queer place, that there's some differences in kind of how law enforcement goes about this in terms of timing, in terms of levels of intimidation. So can you take us through that nuance?
Thanks for drawing that out. Yeah. I guess I would go back to the contrast between 90 Market Street and the Ensign Cafe. So the Ensign's Cafe was the corner of Market and the Embarcadero. It's actually a park, which for a while was referred to as Justin Herman Plaza and Park, named after the head of the redevelopment agency that was largely responsible for spearheading and making this redevelopment project, moving it forward. If you just look at sort of, again, back to the kind of earlier thing, I was trying to understand at the beginning of this process, this whole research project, is the kind of the opening and closing dates. A very simple kind of question, like when did this gay bar open, right? And so that opens a lot of questions. Well, what is a gay bar? And are all gay bars the same? How do you define a gay bar? And when does a gay bar close? Well, on the second part of that, when did these two gay bars close, quote unquote gay bars or hangouts for homosexuals? The Ensign Club is one of the very last buildings in all of this 28 block area that is acquired by the redevelopment agency and torn down. The person who opened the Ensign Club back in the, I think, 1930s, is the last person. He is in continuous operation of this place that for decades, has hosted not only kind of, basically a kind of a sex club in a sense in the basement, but a gay bar, a place where trans people hung out, advertised in sort of national trans magazines, periodically closed, but always opened again. He was a longtime survivor. He was the kind of person who was not a gay person himself, as far as I know, but somebody who was very much operating under this system of police graft. Never made cases. It was never a place that was politicized in quite the same way. It didn't have a queer constituency or kind of bar culture that really organized or pushed against and pushed for political power. And it's telling that it becomes the one that is left to stay to the very end, right? The last one that closes. In contrast, across the street, 90 Market Street, the place I've sort of mentioning, associated with Jose Saria, its last owner operator was a guy named Saul Stoman, who was the same guy who ran the Black Cat. He was the same guy who, all the way to the Supreme Court, defended his right to serve to homosexual patrons. He is the only one of the only businesses in the entire 28 block area of redevelopment agency that actually went bankrupt as a result of the eviction and the dispossession of all of his properties in that area. And it essentially ruined his career. It ruined his business, his bar business. So I guess to your question about policing, there is a very different logic to it. And it has to do with a subset of these waterfront gay bars, the ones that were very politically mobilized and organized, the ones that had fundraisers to raise legal defense funds, the ones where Jose Saria traveled around and got people to register to vote, rallied people, the places that had drag shows that were also fundraisers, the places that advertised in this newspaper, the League of Citizen Education. All of those places met a much more destructive, swift, damaging, violent end at the hand of either the police and/or the Urban Redevelopment Agency, than the one that was across the street, that was essentially a kind of managed vice operation, where people were getting money and grafts was coming out of it, but wasn't actually a place that its patrons were kind of politically organized or radicalized or making any kind of claims of citizenship.
Hmm. Absolutely fascinating to hear those details and sort of see how that all happens. If we bring these things together, then what does actually happen to the queer waterfront if we fast forward to sort of the end of the 1960s? What are we looking at compared to the picture you painted us just a few decades earlier?
Yeah, so in a material sense, in a physical sense, 1963, 64, 65, during those years, those are years of active, like physical destruction, evictions, the razing of buildings, and the rebuilding of the waterfront. What I end the book with, however, and I think this is important, because the book is not just about the destruction of the waterfront. I use this term very intentionally, the creative destruction of the waterfront, or the destruction and the creation of the waterfront, to point to the fact that even almost 10 years later, there is a kind of ongoing, living, shared public memory of the waterfront as a queer place. And I illustrate that with this really amazing collection of photographs that I found that were published in a fundraiser by the International Court System. This is, again, the organization started by Jose Saria. Every year, you know, having a big coronation ceremony to honor the next person who's going to be the Empress for the year, the Queen for the year, and so in the program from I think it's 1972-73 is this really interesting photo montage. It's a quiz where there's a set of maybe 40 photographs. Recent photographs taken around that time, 1972, of sidewalk photos of, you know, parts, bits and pieces of the urban, you know, landscape. And the question is, identify what this past closed gay bar was. So it's actually trying to remember, it's prompting people who are participating in this to remember, oh, 10 years ago, do you remember these places we used to hang out? These are the places that really got started on the waterfront. And many of them, all of them that I sort of was able to sort of talk about in the book, and many of them, all of them that I just sort of mentioned by name, there are more, are captured in photographs. But the photographs are photos of active construction sites, giant holes in the ground, freeway on ramps or off ramps, new parks, that sort of thing. They're physically torn up and they're gone, but they kind of live on in the kind of public memory of the people who recognize the kind of social and political significance of those places, even though that they were long gone. So they were not ephemeral places. They were formative places. And then beyond that, you know, many of the oral histories that I drew from, many of them were collected in the late 70s to the early 90s. You know, that's several decades even later, where people are looking back all the way to the late 40s, early 50s, and reminiscing about these places. These places were powerful in formative in the lives of a number of people kind of move through them, that are places that kind of arouse their sense of sort of social solidarity and their kind of political consciousness.
Hmm. Fascinating.
But they're all gone. They're all gone. And I guess I would also sort of add here, I think it would be a pretty compelling, I think the book provides a really compelling argument for actually renaming what was Justin Herman Plaza, renaming it Jose Saria Plaza, because it really documents and shows this really untold, unknown, previously unknown, unrecognized history, queer history of the waterfront, that was intimately tied to the history of urban renewal and urban redevelopment in San Francisco.
Who knows? Maybe it will be renamed. That would be pretty cool. But even if it isn't, having this history, being able to engage with it, is a massive step forward. So thank you for sharing it with us, leaving me with only my final question. The book is out in the world pretty recently in the last few weeks, but it is available for people to go read and get so many more details than we could possibly cover. Is there anything you might be working on now or next, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact topic, that you'd like to preview for us?
That's a great question. Yeah. I'm taking a little bit of a breather, but my energy is really now
focused.
Yes, thank you. It's been a haul. My energies are now really on ensuring that the stories that I've kind of recounted and the life histories of the people that were integral into kind of transforming the city and also ways of thinking about sexuality in profound ways that it reaches a wider audience. So that's my main focus right now, to make sure that the book does not become just an interesting footnote, but actually really helps us sort of change our thinking about what mobilizes people to work together. What's the nature of sort of social solidarity, and what are the possibilities and prospects for different forms of queer solidarity in world making, in placemaking, in world making. So that's the first thing. And then I guess the second thing I would say, I really am, there's much more that didn't actually make it on the pages of the book. Mm-hmm. There are other stories of urban redevelopment in the city of San Francisco, and how, given multiple options of how to transform and tear down parts of the city and rebuild it, they leaned on and they focused on and they targeted the queer spaces as the places to sort of locate and prioritize redevelopment. So there's some of those that I want to sort of follow along with articles. And then I would really like to know more about, I think there's much more to say about Jose Saria, about Jose Saria, and his role in creating the court system, and the larger sort of national and even international sort of footprint of queer social solidarity and kind of queer bar publics that are still present today that are part of this earlier formula that kind of came out of this sort of past moment. So following that thread forward is also something I'd be very much interested in doing.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for that preview. And I think it's even more reason for people to read the book, because you're still working on a lot of these topics. So again, the title is The City Aroused, Queer Places and Urban Redevelopment in Postwar San Francisco, published by the University of Texas Press in January 2024. So really, thank you so much, Damon, for talking to us about the book and talking to us, you know, right when it's come out. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Miranda. I really appreciate the opportunity.